Marianne and myself have conceived this, our presentation, as two distinct parts that complement each other. Her paper will show that the ritual text from the antiquity transmitted by the literati remain mute on certain funerary practices. And mine aims at comparing the information supplied by ritual texts with the archaeological data. Do the texts match with what we learn from the vestiges? To what extent is it possible to interpret archaeological testimonies through the lenses of ritual texts? Let us have a first look on the documentation that we have at our disposal. The main ritual texts from the antiquity are comprised of several anecdotes on funerals and many descriptions of burial practices. In particular, a long chapter of the Liti, the Tankong, concerns only this topic. In this chapter, most descriptions and stories are seen through the prism of Confucian morals, and even Confucius himself plays a prominent role in some of the stories. In China, since the tombs are very rich, whereas the monuments of the past have left few traces above ground, the archaeologists have focused most of their attention on the excavation of cemeteries and isolated large tombs. By contrast, our knowledge of cities, villages, housing of the early periods is still very poor. Briefly said, Chinese archaeology gives us much more information on the material culture of the dead than on the living. Regarding our investigations today, this situation is very propitious. Today, I shall concentrate on the Tankong chapter, leaving aside the other chapters of the Liti, in order to present different examples of what we can do with these two sources, contrasting sources, the texts and the vestiges. One difficulty for us comes from the nature of the Liti. The funerary rites follow immediately the death of one individual, and like the tears that are shed on that occasion, the rites leave no traces on the soil. The rituals describe gestures, usages, prescriptions that belong to the immaterial culture, whereas tombs provide material remains more than 2 millennia after their construction. Once it has been closed, a tomb represents the ultimate stage of a long process that may have taken from between a few days to several months and even several years. Kings, princes, and members of the aristocracy may have ordered their own tomb be prepared during their lifetime, like the first emperor, who immediately at the beginning of his reign in 221 BC requested that this task to be done from 700,000 workers. In this short presentation, I shall consider the tomb in its physical aspects, starting from a few terms, from remarks and short stories that appear in the Tankong. The first term that has attracted my attention is Rezang, joint burial, which is also said as Fu, ritual of attachment. The commentators explain this term as the reopening of a tomb to add another coffin, in general the coffin of a wife. Rezang appears in three anecdotes of the Tankong. One of them, in particular, shows Confucius who wants to bury his mother in the same tomb as his father. However, since he lost his father at a very young age, he ignores the place where it is located. After having asked a woman who knew about the site, he could bury his mother together with his father. The Liti indicates that the custom consisting of reopening a tomb was already used at the beginning of the Zhou dynasty. That is, in the second half of the 11th century BC. In fact, this statement is absolutely wrong. Since no tomb dating to the period before the empire, among dozens of thousands that have been excavated to date, shows any trace of such reopening. Nothing would have been more horrifying than to reopen a tomb at that time. Even someone moved by strong feelings of filial piety would not have put together the coffins of his father and mother in the same tomb. In fact, the burial architecture of the Zhou period did not allow the reopening of a tomb. Tombs were hermetically sealed and composed of a pit that could be between 1 meter to nearly 20 meters deep. According to the social status of the owner, though in rare cases, one or two sloping entry ramps that we can see here and there could give access to the pit. During the time of the funerals, one ramp with steps for the bereaved, and in front of that ramp, another ramp to lower the coffin and the furnishings. In most cases, there was no ramp at all. In fact, at the end of the funerals, the pit was filled with layers of rammed earth, together with stones, fine clay, so that nobody could penetrate inside the tomb. When archaeologists find two or several coffins in a tomb, this is because the deceased had been followed by individuals of their own free will, or more or less free, with the promise of a life in the next world similar to the one they enjoyed on earth, or even better, and out of fidelity. These persons were spouses, concubines, and servants. During the Han period, the architecture of the tombs underwent radical transformations. Their construction developed horizontally, and the most wealthy became subterranean palaces, like dwellings for the living. The largest were closed by double-leaf doors. They were comprised of a corridor, an antechamber, one or several chambers and rooms. It was also possible to circulate inside the tombs. The first tombs built according to this model appeared in the 2nd century BC. They were rock-cut burials, but a few decades later, they would be built with bricks. A ramp leading to the door of this new kind of tombs allowed several members of the same family to be buried together inside. The complete adoption of new principles in the architecture of the tombs, from a vertical to a horizontal construction, was achieved in the 1st century AD. Very probably, this revolution generated debates when the new mode of construction was initiated. And the anecdote of the Tankong, in which Confucius uses the Huizhen for his parents, was intended to promote this new custom consisting in reopening a tomb. To understand why Confucius is mentioned in an anecdote about the Huizhen, one has to examine, again, the burial customs of his time. In fact, in antiquity, tombs of husbands and wives used to be located at a short distance, one from another, and oriented in the same direction. In exceptional cases, like the two tombs of Guangshan Pao Xiangse that we have here, the two wooden chambers are in the same pit, less than 1 meter away and covered by a common mound. In fact, these burials were built a few years apart, around 700 BC. The first for a lord's wife and the other one for her husband. Therefore, I suggest that initially the term Huizhen meant joint tombs, indicating that two tombs could be built very close together, even in the same pit. During the Han period, the meaning of the Huizong had completely changed, since two persons could be buried into the same tomb. Huizong then meant common burial. In the Liti, strange descriptions of graves are made for the Zhou period and earlier. First of all, the Zhou tombs are described in general terms as if only one common model existed everywhere in the kingdom and had not evolved during no less than 8 centuries, the length of time of that dynasty. In fact, several funerary traditions existed at the same time. In the Warring States period, there existed two main contrasting traditions. One originated in the Qin state, on the right side, the other one in the Chu kingdom, on the left side. The first is called catacomb tomb, since the coffin was placed in a chamber dug laterally into one side of the vertical pit, here. In the Chu kingdom, the coffin was deposited into a wooden and compartmented chamber, like this, called outer coffin. In this short description that we have here, different burial customs are opposed for each successive period or dynasty in a way that suggests a continuous progress ending with the Zhou tradition as its ultimate stage. Each period is characterized by specific customs, some of which never existed. For example, the earthenware coffins could suggest funerary urns. However, in antiquity, these urns were used only for children. They became to be used for adults after the diffusion of Buddhism, much later than the time when the Liti was compiled. The word Ti is traditionally explained as a wall made of bricks. In fact, bricks began to be used in tombs much later than the time of the Xia Huo clan, almost 2 millenniums later. Finally, the word Sha, here, which is translated by Couvreur as a big fan and as an emblem by Eno, does not make sense in the context of burials. It could be a banner, like the banner of Ma Wangtui, Tomb 1, near Changsha. A small number of banners have been discovered in tombs of the Chu kingdom and located in what was formerly its territory, the Hubei, the Hunan, the Shantung. These banners were deposited on the lid of the coffin, and in the case of Tomb 1 at Ma Wangtui, represented the deceased receiving homage and offerings from her relatives before her soul ascended to paradise. They appeared in the 3rd century BC, but one does not know whether their use was limited to the Chu kingdom or shared by people from other regions. The presence of encased coffins was restricted to persons having a high status, to begin with the Son of Heaven, who supposedly had 4 encased coffins. This is also mentioned in other texts like the Mozi and the Lushu Chuntio. To date, none of the tombs of the Zhou kings has been excavated. It is therefore not possible to confirm these assertions, in particular that a coffin could have been made in leather. In fact, the coffins are always made of wood and sometimes lacquered. In the Chu kingdom, it was considered most important to secure the coffins very firmly, and this was done by tying hemp ropes in both directions with sticks added to tighten them. Later, in the 4th century BC, the ropes were replaced by silk ribbons and lacquered textile bands. it is still difficult to confirm that this custom was specific to Chu, since in other regions than the ancient territory of Chu, the tombs are rarely in good state of preservation. However, it is clear that the Liti mentions these bands and tenons. Mingti are objects made specifically for tombs. They may be often were replicas of bronze ritual vessels or defective objects that cannot be used, for example, bronze ritual vessels badly cast, but whose walls have holes. They also may be musical instruments out of tune, or bells deposited on the ground floor, hence, that cannot be struck. On repeated occasions, the Mingzi are mentioned in the Liti. It is not possible to review now this complex problem. However, the archaeological excavations have shown that initially, the Mingzi were imitations of ritual vessels in cheap metal like lead or tin or earthenware. These vessels could not be used because of their reduced size, like these small vessels, or because their lid could not be removed, like this one. Some vessels have no bottom, this one. During centuries, from the 9th to the 5th century BC, they appear in very small numbers in the tombs. During that period, most of the vessels deposited into tombs belonged to real ritual sets and were of the best quality. This was the way of paying homage to the deceased. Men and women alike were buried with these ritual sets. There was an extremely close connection between the social order and the ritual practices. These ritual vessels and objects used in the ancestral cult were called titi. From the early 4th century BC, in the Chu Kingdom, bronze ritual vessels were replaced by earthenware substitutes, imitating perfectly shapes and decoration of bronzes. Progressively, the custom of using cheap substitutes of ritual bronzes spread to the central plain. There is a slide which is missing, but doesn't matter. I was showing some of the Mingzi that we find in a tomb. More surprisingly, in many tombs of the Chu elite, cheap ceramic substitutes and lacquer imitations replaced the ritual bronzes. This is the case in tomb 1 and 2 at Wangshan that belonged to members of the royal family of Chu. At least 50 such earthenware perfect imitations of ritual vessels were deposited in the tomb, dating to the last decades of the 4th century BC. In the Liti, Confucius is quoted as having said that the dead must have special treatment. They should not be treated like the living. This is why specific objects, the Mingzi, would be made for them. However, it seems to me that at the beginning of the 5th century BC, the debate about real objects versus Mingzi had not yet happened. It is only in the late 4th century BC and even later that this question would have been debated, when the composition of burial furnishings had seen radical transformations. From that period on, in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC, the burial furnishings would comprise two main kinds of objects, the Mingzi and objects of daily life that could evoke the environment that the deceased had liked during his or her life. In the tombs of the elite, the first category consisted in cheap objects imitating ritual objects And the second category was composed of the most luxury items taken from the house where the deceased had been living. In fact, at the beginning of the empire, the Ming Qi would evolve again, initially limited to the imitation of ritual vessels. They began to imitate all kinds of objects of daily life, like models of chariots or kitchen ovens, or even sculptures of mannequins modeled on servants or warriors. And here also is a kind of a tower. Therefore, between the late Bronze Age and the early Empire, the composition of burial furnishings has known three stages. In the early phase, the main part of the furnishings consisted in bronze ritual sets. Then, in the middle phase, around the 5th and 4th century BC, earthenware imitations of ritual vessels were mixed with real objects of daily life, and in the last phase, the Ming Qi constituted most of the objects deposited in the tomb. It seems to me that the words by Confucius quoted in the Tan Kong about the burial furnishings could only have been pronounced by someone living in a society where only objects of this kind of Ming Qi would have been provided to the deceased, that is, at the beginning of the empire. From the few examples that I have presented here, what can we learn about the Li Ti, and more precisely about the Tan Kong? This is my conclusion. In that chapter, a few pieces of information are confirmed by the archaeological finds. Some other details remain unclear, and in some cases, the comments do not clarify the meaning of what is obscure to us. The information supplied in this chapter about burial customs seems to have been gathered in various regions from different sources and dating from different times. The past is mixed with the present. The information seemed to have been assembled without a clear order and probably without critical examination. The anecdotes collected in the Tan Kong were probably chosen in order to answer the questions that were debated among scholars at the beginning of the empire about the rites to be observed during the funerals. All these remarks should invite us to be cautious in our reading of the Li Ti. Thank you.